This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You're under the same rules as regular staff.
Several times, no.
Okay. Do you do the officer?
Sir, turn around. Put your body back.
Come on, Mr. Chairman.
What's the decision?
Mr. Chairman, we discussed this before.
This is a public hearing. This is a public hearing, and within my First Amendment rights, and I'm being taken out.
Well, but before the meeting has begun and before the subcommittee has had a chance to discuss the issue, this guy is being led away in handcuffs. I'd like to move that he be allowed to film this
motion,
meeting.
Motion's out of order. We're not in the hearing.
Well, then can you gavel the hearing in before this guy's...
That's at my discretion.
In addition to the fellow who's just escorted out, who I understand was not credentialed, although he's, I understand, filming an HBO documentary, an ABC crew showed up earlier, and they were turned away on the stated reason that they had not requested to film in advance. I think all those rules are to control access where there's limited access. It is very clear that we have space in this room for either of them to testify or to film this hearing. If you claim that rule does not provide, does not allow them to film, or more accurately, allows you the discretion, the majority, the power to turn them away, I move that the rules be suspended to the end, that the HBO, the fellow who wanted to film for HBO be allowed to film this hearing, and that ABC News be allowed to film this hearing, and All God's Children be allowed to film this hearing until the room is too full to conduct our business.
That was Congressman Brad Miller of North Carolina. He is protesting the ejection of the media from a hearing into an EPA study concluding gas fracking has ruined the drinking water of farmers in Pavilion, Wyoming. Miller was overruled by the Republican chair and the media kept out. So much for government transparency. It didn't matter much. The witnesses mostly represented the gas industry anyway. And Obama thinks fracking is great. The Congress didn't hear this story from rancher John Fenton of Wyoming.
I will start right off. Like I said, my name is John Fenton. I farm and ranch in Pavilion, Wyoming. Pavilion area was heavily drilled for natural gas. There was really no consideration given to well spacing or the impacts on the people or the environment. Our land and the land of our neighbors has been damaged and devalued. The water has been contaminated and the air fouled. Our health has also been attacked. My wife is losing her sense of smell and her sense of taste. My youngest son has developed seizures, and I suffer chronic headaches and fatigue. When the people of Pavilion area begin to notice negative impacts to their water, they look to the state and industry to provide answers and help to remedy the contamination. However, there was no help from the state of Wyoming or the natural gas industry. The people of the Pavilion area were told that there was no way the natural gas drilling and fracking operations in the Pavilion area could have caused damage to their water. And when industry did admit that problems existed, they very often blamed the impacts on the landowner, saying that they lacked proper hygiene or that they had contaminated the wells themselves. So for over a decade, the residents of the Pavilion area tried without success to get the state of Wyoming to investigate the problems in the Pavilion area. The state never performed any tests of their own. Instead, they stood behind test results provided by Encana and maintained the position that there was no contamination in the Pavilion area. The water turned black, smelled like petroleum, and bubbled with gas. And we were being sacrificed. The Environmental Protection Agency was approached by the people of Pavilion with concerns of contamination that had gone ignored by the state of Wyoming. And really, we wondered even who in the state had the expertise or the resources to perform the testing that investigation that needed to be done in the area. But the EPA came to the Pavilion area and investigated the contamination. After 3 years of testing and investigation, a draft report was released at the end of 2011. It's clear that the deep zones are highly contaminated, and we fear that the methane is pushing contaminants up into the drinking water zones. Improper casing techniques and improper well construction techniques have played a large part in this, and really as the result of an industry that's under zero oversight. And although the deep levels of contamination in the deep water are extremely high, the shallow water shows a lot of times very low contamination in our drinking wells. Although these constituents that show up at these low levels are still very, very dangerous at the low levels. But even after all this, the findings of the report were immediately attacked by the state of Wyoming and the natural gas industry and industry-friendly politicians. The congressional hearing regarding the EPA investigation in Pavilion, Wyoming is entitled Crack Science. And all this while the people still sit here suffering the impacts and have lately pretty much been forgotten in the political jousting that's been going on.
That was John Fenton of Pavilion, Wyoming. Listen for more coverage on the health impacts of fracking for gas on Radio EcoShock. In this program, you'll hear the voices of Congress and the voices Congress doesn't want you to hear. U.S. Representative Andy Harris, Republican from Maryland, will announce his attack on the EPA study showing fracking poisoning well water in Pavilion, Wyoming. Congressman Brad Miller, Democrat from North Carolina, shows up as the only person to speak out for fracking victims and the EPA. Theo Colburn of TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, tells you about the choking, toxic airborne chemicals from fracking. The EPA spokesman at this Energy and Environment Subcommittee I mentioned, the EPA Hydraulic Fracking Research, held February 1, 2012 in Washington, was Regional Administrator James B. Martin. His defense of the science was weak, I must say, and as we'll hear in our concluding interview with whistleblower Marsha Coleman Adebayo, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency is already weakened from within by persistent racism, sexism, and cover-ups for corporate America. That's a full slate as committee sub-chairman Andy Harris begins and calls repeatedly for transparency. Keep in mind his action before the web cameras were turned on. Harris had Josh Fox, the famous director of the Oscar-nominated fracking film Gasland, arrested.
I want to welcome everyone to this morning's hearing to examine EPA's approach to groundwater research near Pavilion, Wyoming. The increased production and use of clean natural gas is the source of one of the few bright spots in our current economic climate. In 2010, the shale gas industry supported 600,000 jobs, and a Federal Reserve economist estimates that lower natural gas prices enabled by increased production saved American consumers more than $16 billion in home energy costs last year. And, of course, the price of natural gas has come down since last year. So it would be more than $16 billion in home energy costs saved each year from natural gas. Wyoming is a perfect case study. Tens of thousands of people are employed in oil and gas production, and royalties and taxes on that production delivered almost $2 billion going to state and local taxpayer coffers, more than $3,400 for every citizen in the state. However, in a remarkable display of arrogance and disregard for the plain facts, the president, in his State of the Union address last week, proclaimed his support for expanded shale gas production, while at the same time allowing every part of his administration, from the EPA to the Department of the Interior to the CDC, to attack these practices through scientific innuendo and regulatory straitjacketing. In the past year, the subcommittee has held numerous hearings on EPA's use and abuse of science. Time and again, we have demonstrated that this agency is substituting outcome-driven science for rigorous objective science. EPA's investigation of groundwater contamination in Pavilion appears to be yet another example of politics trumping policy and advocacy trumping science. EPA will no doubt emphasize today that this is a draft report that will soon undergo peer review. This fails to acknowledge, however, the impact this report has already had. The day after the draft report was released, the governor of Delaware announced that it was the validation for his decision to vote against development of natural gas in the Delaware River Basin. This illustrates the power of EPA's press release science to drive public opinion and even critical decisions by policymakers. The key question before us today is, was the investigation conducted in a scientifically robust manner that justifies all this potential economic upheaval? I look forward to hearing from witnesses, but I am concerned about indications that EPA's approach in Wyoming has been poorly conducted, unnecessarily alarming, and fits within the pattern of an outcome-driven, regulate-for-any-excuse philosophy at the agency. Transparency is central to getting to the bottom of these scientific questions. Regardless that the president boasts that he leads the, quote, most transparent administration in history, and despite receiving multiple requests from state, media, and interested stakeholders, interestingly enough, it was not until late last night, the eve of this hearing, that the EPA finally disclosed data essential to meaningfully evaluate their findings. Now, note that the original deadline for comment passed 2 weeks ago. Well, I'm not sure how the EPA thought that people were going to make decisions on the adequacy of this study without the information that now the EPA, I guess, feels essential to make those kind of determinations. Now, while I'm pleased that EPA posted 622 documents to its website last night, now I would offer that maybe they should follow the same rules the House has, that you need 3 days of putting something out before you should actually consider it. Clearly, that's not enough time for this committee to take that into consideration in the hearing today. It is unfortunate that this transparency appears only to have been compelled by the calling of a congressional oversight hearing. But then again, maybe that's the purpose of the 112th Congress. Compounding this problem is the complete failure to collaborate with experts and institutions with knowledge in the unique hydrogeology of this region. For example, the state of Wyoming, despite possessing decades of experience in groundwater assessments, was not consulted with about the most important aspects of this investigation. And we'll hear from one of our witnesses today about that. The agency did not even consult with the U.S. Geological Survey before releasing the report, a sister government agency that has extensive understanding of aquifer complexity and geographical characteristics in the region. Also concerning is EPA's apparent failures to follow its own laboratory protocols, Superfund site requirements, peer review handbook, information quality guidelines, as well as U.S. Geological Survey recommendations for drilling and sampling monitoring wells. Hypocritically, these are behaviors and practices that the agency would never accept from any state or private sector entity conducting a comprehensive groundwater investigation. Finally, I'm afraid EPA's actions in Pavilion demonstrate a disturbing loss of perspective. The principal concern of this investigation should always have been the health and welfare of the people living near Pavilion, Wyoming. Unfortunately, in its single-minded pursuit of the hydraulic fracturing smoking gun, EPA appears to have lost focus on identifying the real causes of and real solutions to drinking water quality problems locally in Pavilion, Wyoming. I want to thank the witnesses for appearing before the subcommittee, and I look forward to a constructive discussion. The chair now recognizes Mr. Miller for 5 minutes of an opening statement.
Thank you, Chairman Harris. The stated purpose of this hearing is to examine the methodology, the quality assurance, the peer review process, and the like of an EPA study that links hydraulic fracturing or fracking and groundwater contamination near Pavilion, Wyoming. The principal criticism of the EPA is that the EPA's procedures have lacked transparency. EPA conducted the study in response to requests by citizens in the area. After fracking operations began there, they began to suffer headaches, sore throat, nausea, sinus problems, and other symptoms that are known to be associated with the contaminants found in Pavilion's drinking water supply by the EPA study. EPA, it is a draft report. It's the product of 3 years of research. The report is subject to a public comment period, followed by peer review. EPA has extended the public comment period from 45 days to 90 days at the request of industry. Public comments are due by March 12, 2012. EPA is now soliciting also nominations for disinterested experts to serve as peer reviewers. Real scientists, not members of the science committee, real scientists. Once selected, the peer review panel will have 30 days to complete their work. In other words, the Pavilion study is a work in progress, and all the criticisms we will hear today are part of the public comment and part of the peer review process. The Pavilion study does not call for any regulation of fracking. Their study is part of risk assessment, not risk management. Risk assessment informs risk management. Once we know the risk, EPA will then weigh the economic benefits and potential public health consequences of fracking to determine what safeguards, if any, are appropriate to develop needed natural gas resources while protecting the environment and public health. Although the industry and their political allies dismiss the concerns about fracking as uninformed hysteria, their refusal to provide basic information about the operations, their operations, and their efforts to hinder independent scientific research like the Pavilion study cannot be reassuring to citizens living near fracking operations. The industry has refused to disclose the chemicals they inject into the earth, claiming the information is proprietary, their secret sauce. But the draft pavilion study is not the only study to find groundwater contamination and at least one instance of surface water contamination near fracking operations by chemicals not ordinarily found in nature and known to be part of the secret sauce. Some of the chemicals are known carcinogens. In short, the public concern about fracking seems very reasonable. The question is not whether we are pro-drilling or anti-drilling. The question is whether we will drill with our eyes open. The public wants to know if fracking is safe, and they're entitled to know. But the industry and their political allies just say, in effect, move along. There's nothing to see here. The integrity of scientific research at EPA is properly the subject of this subcommittee's interest. Although none of the Republican witnesses today appear to satisfy the requirements of disinterested expertise to serve as peer reviewers. With no disinterested scientists as witnesses, a reasonable question is whether this hearing is really about the science, the integrity of the science, or if it's just a big wink and nod to the industry that the majority is on their side no matter what. I yield back the balance of my time.
This is Radio EcoShock. You just heard Congressman Brad Miller following Representative Andy Harris in a recording from the Republican-led House Committee titled Fractured Science, Examining EPA's Approach to Groundwater Research, the Pavilion Analysis. The witnesses were heavily stacked in favor of the fossil fuel industry. We heard from Tom Dahl from the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The state makes big money from fracking. Tom Dahl claimed the EPA caused the pollution they found just by drilling two test wells. Even the man-made chemicals must have come from this testing, Dahl suggests. Next up, Ms. Kathleen Sagama, a PR person from the Western Energy Alliance, says, well, mistakes happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ranking Member Miller and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity today. Western Energy Alliance represents about 400 companies engaged in all aspects of environmentally responsible oil and gas development in Wyoming and across the West. There is no fail-safe process, and accidents may happen with any human endeavor. One of the main roles of environmental regulation is to ensure that the risk is managed properly, that appropriate procedures are in place to prevent public exposure, and in the event of an accident, that problems are corrected. Oil and natural gas producers are held to high scientific standards to ensure operations are properly designed, executed, and controlled. My industry struggles against outrageous information in the public arena and that overstates our environmental impact and propagates blatantly false information about hydraulic fracturing. Every day we hear members of the media and unaccountable environmental groups make statements about supposedly thousands of cases of contamination. Never mind that EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson and most regulators from large oil and natural gas producing states have felt compelled to issue statements about the lack of cases of contamination from fracking. Once misinformation gets out in the public, it takes on a life of its own and is almost impossible to correct. This misinformation has caused local communities and citizens to fear a process that is safe. The fear leads to development roadblocks, depriving state economies of tens of thousands of jobs and billions of dollars of economic activity. Furthermore, unfounded fears about fracking divert limited federal and state resources away from activities that truly pose a threat to underground sources of drinking water. The Groundwater Protection Council considers fracking low risk, especially compared to other threats such as agricultural runoff, septic systems, sewer lines, and wastewater treatment sources. The public trusts EPA to follow the law and use sound science as the foundation of its regulatory work. When EPA releases a report stating that fracking may be the cause of contamination, the public expects that to be backed by science. However, in the case of the draft pavilion report, EPA's own data contained within doesn't support the conclusions presented up front. A conclusion with such broad implications should have first been tested through a scientific peer review of the work. We are left wondering why EPA would jump to conclusions. Why would EPA release the report without state input and scientific peer review? These are disturbing questions to ask about an agency that should have the public trust and points to the fact that EPA is also a political body, not a disinterested scientific institution. As this committee knows, fundamental standards of science include objectivity, repeatability, transparency, and peer review. It's hard to call something scientific if it doesn't include these basic elements, yet we've seen examples from EPA that do not. Industry is particularly concerned since Congress has charged EPA with conducting a scientific study of fracking. EPA's recent actions raise questions in our minds about the quality of the science for the broader fracking study as well. The Pavilion report and what we've observed so far in the fracking study cause great concern to industry as we see a lack of transparency, unscientific methods, and failure to perform peer review. I ask this committee to help ensure that the issues of scientific credibility are resolved. I believe in general that better oversight is needed of EPA science. There's an inherent conflict given EPA's regulatory and compliance roles and its ability to conduct objective science.
That was Kathleen Sagama for the Western Energy Alliance, representing 400 companies in the fracking industry, as she attacked the EPA for claiming fracking had damaged groundwater in Wyoming. In 2004, a law was passed prohibiting the Environmental Protection Agency from regulating fracking under the Safe Drinking Water Act. It was a Bush-era giveaway to the industry, which has left Americans blinded to the impacts of fracking on water supplies and the very toxic chemicals used by the industry. What about the impacts of all the volatile chemicals going up into the air? The EPA does not monitor that either. There haven't been any real studies of the health impacts of fracking for either workers or people who live near fracking. And before you say, well, they shouldn't have let the companies in, remember, especially in the West, most homeowners and ranchers don't hold the underground rights. In the case of Pavilion, Wyoming, those rights were held either by the Federal Bureau of Land Management or by Native tribes. Fracking can pop up anywhere and put a 24-hour-a-day well, generators, trucks, and pumps within 400 feet of your bedroom window. It's all perfectly legal, even if it kills you. And gas fracking is booming all over the world, in the UK, in Canada, in New Zealand, Australia, and many more countries. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and here is, as the famous broadcaster used to say, the rest of the story on the air pollution from fracking.
My name is Theo Colborne. I am a professor emeritus at the University of Florida, Gainesville, and also have an honorary doctorate of science from the University of Colorado. I am also president of TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, that I started here in Paonia, Colorado in 2002 when I found out that my back was not going to let me work in Washington, D.C. Before that, of course, I was operating the Wildlife and Contaminants Program at World Wildlife Fund, and from the very beginning, my work started with the International Joint Commission, and all of my activity has grown out of what we learned about what's going on in the Great Lakes. So I accepted this opportunity from John to speak today in order to bring you another perspective that has been sadly neglected and sort of swept under the rug. Most of you probably do not remember Paul Harvey, you're too young, I bet, who many years ago had a talk radio news program. He called it The Rest of the Story. Well, that is what I want to do today. Tell the rest of the story of what it is like to work and live where natural gas industrialization is taking place. We will look at a major problem that has made it impossible to adequately regulate the natural gas industry and protect public health. The problem is being that the complete lack of air pollution monitoring. And to do this, I'm going to focus on exposure, those who are being exposed, and what the difficulty of providing proof of exposure means to those who work and live where natural gas activity takes place. So setting water pollution aside, what follows focuses on the invisible and oftentimes odorless chemicals that people suspect have made them ill long before the drinking water could become contaminated. We will look at four examples of sources for airborne chemicals that could be causing overt and covert health problems for those who work and live in gas patches. We'll talk about volatile chemicals introduced deliberately. We'll look at exhaust from mobile and stationary equipment. We'll look at hydrogen sulfide under certain conditions and fugitive gas other than methane from underground that I call the sleeper. At TEDx, we spent years putting together a list of products that are used during drilling and fracking to get natural gas out of the ground. This list is available on our website. As we compiled the list of products, we also listed the chemicals that the companies revealed were in their products. There are 980 products on the list. Of these, 421, or 43%, provided less than 1% information about what is in them, and only 14% gave the full formulation. Now, we were able to find the names of 649 chemicals in those products, but only 362 had a specific chemical name, and out of those 362 identifiable chemicals, 36% are volatile, many of which have adverse health effects. These chemicals are deliberately added to the fluids used to facilitate the release of the natural gas from the ground. Here you see the health profiles of the volatile chemicals plotted against the water-soluble chemicals, and it shows the frequency of the chemicals having possible health effects. As you can see, the volatile chemicals were more toxic than the water-soluble. 95% of the chemicals cause eye, nose, and skin irritation, often the first effect workers and residents complain about, as well as sensory organ irritation, the scratchy throat, ringing of ears, rashes, chronic sinus problems, and often headaches. Then moving to the right, we move into the respiratory symptoms, asthma, sinus problems, and flu-like complaints. Then next, go to the right to gastrointestinal problems, because so many chemicals make people feel nauseous. And then there is the brain and central and peripheral nervous systems that show up next for 85% of the chemicals. Then kidney, cardiovascular, and blood. And note that cancer drops down to 30%. But then endocrine disruption, which includes reproductive and developmental effects, bounces back up to 50%. Abnormal bone development or outright death are most often associated with the other column. And, of course, ecological effects that include wildlife, where in some instances certain chemicals at the invertebrate level are very sensitive at the very low end of our food web. These man-made VOCs used for fracking or drilling could escape during the chemical mixing process for both the drilling and fracking fluids, during injection while drilling and fracking, and then during flowback when the fracking fluids start coming back up to the surface, and especially while the recovered fluids are stored in open reserve pits on the pad or until the fluids are totally disposed of. The second source of chemicals is the VOCs from combustion of diesel and other fuels to maintain mobile and stationary equipment during operations. They are in the exhaust stream that is released in large volumes 24/7 throughout both drilling and fracking operations. Many of the wells drilled in Colorado within the past decade took as much as a month to complete. Today, using new sophisticated rigs and diamond drill bits, but don't expect to have these in your neighborhood, a drill event may still take as long as a week or more. To back this equipment up, there will be many huge tanker trucks coming and going to the pad, carrying a constant supply of both diesel fuel and water. They sit in long lines, idling their motors, waiting their turn to unload. In addition, many auxiliary service pickup trucks move in and out of the pad throughout the day and night. To their exhaust is added the exhaust from huge generators and compressors that burn diesel to maintain pressure throughout all the operations. And added to all that is the flaring or burning off of the natural gas that escapes from the ground the minute the drill bore hits gas in the target stratum. That is a pad where drilling and fracking is finished. Well, okay, that pad is finished. Now they're apparently waiting to hook up to the local delivery line and bring the well to completion. But all during that time, they let the gas escape by flaring. Flaring may go on for months. We have a well near us that has been waiting for a year that has been flaring. The flaring exacerbates exposure by contributing fine particulate matter to the air that for many individuals causes irritation and respiratory problems. And I know one man who has convulsions if he gets downwind from a flare. And yet another overlooked source of exposure is hydrogen sulfide in areas where there are sulfides in the soil and where chemicals in open pits can react and produce it. Hydrogen sulfide has a rotten-egg smell, but it is harmful long before you can smell it. It has been a bane to welders on oil and gas pads for years. Most of them now wear wrist monitors to detect it. But the most overlooked chemicals the workforce and neighbors will come in contact with are the native VOCs that come to the surface in the natural gas along with the methane. Methane, the largest volatile component in natural gas at about 85% or more, is not toxic. But many of the other gases that escape from the ground with the methane come with their own set of health problems. They can escape at every juncture, from equipment on the pad, like the Christmas trees where the gas comes up from the ground, especially from heater treaters, where gases and oils are separated from the fluids that come up with the gas, and at every other piece of stationary equipment, like compressors and then pigging stations all along the pipelines. Despite all of the above, neither the federal government nor industry is doing much monitoring of the air environment around natural gas activity. The good news is that some citizens have managed to get the money to take some infrared pictures that reveal the fugitive gases leaking from all kinds of stationary equipment on and off the pad. And better yet, local citizens have started what is called the Bucket Brigade, in which they do their own sampling, and even some counties are doing some cross-sectional sampling. So here we provide just a partial list of the health effects of those chemicals that have 11 health effects out of a possible 12. A large percent interfere with the brain and the endocrine system, which operates at extremely low concentrations. You know from the work around the Great Lakes, endocrine disrupting chemicals can have devastating impacts on wildlife and humans. For most of these chemicals, there are no government safety standards to identify at what level exposure leads to harm. And for those where a safety standard may have been established, the standard was based on an 8-hour workday, 5 days a week, for a 70-kilogram man working in a confined area. None of those standards took into consideration effects on the endocrine system and the consequences of prenatal exposure. So let's take a look at the jobs that are going to be available for people who like to work outside. Other than a handful of salaried managers working directly for the large corporations, the bulk of the labor force needed to get the gas into commerce works on contracts, subcontracts, and sub-subcontracts. We have even run into a situation where someone was hired through a temp agency as a sub-sub-subcontractor and without proper training went to work and in less than 3 hours ended up in the hospital emergency room. We have verified with many contract employees that they had to sign a contract in which they agreed never to reveal their hourly wage or talk about their health and must never call 911 if they became ill or involved in an accident. If they do, they will be fired. They are given a company phone number to call instead. The workday is 12 hours or more, and can be as long as 21 consecutive days or more, no weekends. One chemical mixer admits to working for as long as 36 hours, staying on the job throughout an entire fracking event. Now, these jobs start at about $15 an hour for the first 40 hours, but with double and triple time, that can come to more than $77,000 a year. But they get no health insurance, and Social Security and income tax are not taken out of their pay. So if you take one of the following contract jobs, you will be exposed to many chemicals that are airborne. The jobs will vary while working on the pad during drilling or fracking. You could be a mudder who mixes the chemicals with the drilling muds, a rigger who helps direct each length of pipe into the preceding length of pipe from way up on the side of the rig. You could end up being a plumber of sorts, fitting and refitting new and old pipe on the drill rigs and shifting and reconnecting pipes from one fitting to another. Here is a man unloading a huge tank to put on a pad. You can see the fittings on the right-hand end where the pipes are coming out. That will be down on the ground. And this could be used to hold the water stripped off the gas as it comes from the ground. And then the trucks back up and take the water out of these tanks as they fill up. Here you see dozens of fracking tanks lined up, ready to take flow back at the end of the frack. A welder is needed constantly throughout both drilling and fracking as pipes are moved from one connection to another. Or you can even end up welding inside a fracking tank. Or if you work for the company that owns the fracking tanks, you could work inside the tank with a steam cleaner and chemicals scrubbing them down. You could also get a job doing what is called workover on the pads of aging or retired wells that are now needing upgrading and brought online. And lots of these have been found leaking across the country. You might also join a large cohort that will move in as the drillers and frackers leave to take over the maintenance and cleaning of the infrastructure they left behind that needs attention 24/7 for the life of the gas field, which could be decades. One of the largest job cohorts exposed to a broad spectrum of chemicals but does not work on the well pad is the drivers of the fleets of the long tubular water trucks. When they pick up recovered wastewater on well pads and haul it to disposal sites, sometimes 100 miles away in another state, they are exposed at both ends as they stand there by the truck's load and while their truck's empty. These laborers are all hired, again, under contract, and again, without access to insurance, and many with gag orders not to discuss their health. So, I have talked with men after they became too ill to work and have had trouble getting any kind of compensation. They admit from the first week on the job, they experienced a suite of symptoms similar to those that many residents have complained about when drilling starts in their neighborhood, from headaches, burning eyes and skin, coughing, flu-like symptoms, asthma, and insomnia. And they also discover they have hypertension and other systemic problems, which like anyone could experience as he or she ages. But there is no way for clinicians to relate those symptoms with chemical exposure. For many laborers and residents, the nervous system symptoms are the same. So many experiencing peripheral neuropathy, numbness and tingling in their hands and feet, and plagued with totally unpredictable pain, fibromyalgia, and swelling in their arms, feet and legs, and outright multiple chemical sensitivity. It is when the men and women begin to develop tremors, memory loss, and experience convulsions, symptoms of MCS, and deep depression, so that they cannot work anymore and turn to workman's compensation. They find out that they cannot collect because they have nothing to prove they were exposed to something. Whether a resident or a natural gas industry contract worker, they have nowhere to turn to be compensated for their misery and loss of income that essentially started when the drilling started. Homeowners find themselves in a bind. Too ill to stay where they are. Look at the people living down in this house here to the left. They have no money to move somewhere else to rent because they still have a mortgage on the house that they can't sell. And most of those that I have met are fighting terrible insecurity and depression. It is a tragedy that EPA was told it could not look into air pollution in its upcoming report on fracking. This was a serious omission on the part of the government. And it's true that water contamination poses serious concerns to potable and agricultural water wherever natural gas drilling and reinjection is occurring. But while water contamination is a possibility, you can be sure that air contamination is a certainty. Now, I know that water is of extreme importance to you around the Great Lakes, where you provide water for many people and many purposes. But I want you to know that we, too, in the West, are very concerned about water. Here you see some water trucks lined up along the Colorado River, taking water from the river to haul back to a fracking event. Because if you shift the camera just a little to the left and look downstream, you will be able to see where one of the trucks had bad brakes and rolled into the Colorado River. It got stuck on something there just downstream from the bridge. That river serves 35 million people downstream.
That was Theo Colburn of TEDx, the Endocrine Disruption Exchange, at endocrinedisruption.com. She was speaking in a press conference for the nonprofit citizens group Great Lakes United on January 10, 2012. Shortly after this program, you can download a recording of the whole teleconference from the Energy section at our website, ecoshock.org. I recommend it. You will hear so many people sick and worried sick about fracking. At the start of this program, we delved into the House hearing on an EPA study. I was distressed to see the weak presentation by the EPA regional administrator. It turns out the EPA itself, even as it is hobbled by industry and the White House, is also weakened by a long regime of disturbing behavior inside. It's an honor to talk with Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo, who has been through it all.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Maybe you suspect the white male establishment doesn't care about the health of women and minorities. And we do hear little stories about lives disabled and lost overseas making our consumer products. But what happens if you know for sure it's true and you speak out? Our guest is Dr. Marcia Coleman Adebayo. She is a fearless whistleblower at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. She sued the government for sexual and racial discrimination and won. And then she stimulated a new law called the No Fear Act. Now Dr. Coleman Adebayo is founder of the No Fear Coalition. Marcia, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much for having me.
I do admit right off the bat, I totally underestimated the huge issues you raise in your book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph. It's more than a personal story of bravery, and it's not just about America. What did you find at the EPA?
I think that this deals with the way the United States government looks at people inside the government that decide to reject the code of silence. This is what I, in my book, I talk about green crimes. You know, we know a lot about white-collar crimes, and we know that when police officers protect themselves, we call that sort of a blue crime. But what about green crimes? And so my book sort of explores green crimes on both sides of the Atlantic, both in the United States government, inside the federal government itself, as well as in Africa. And in the United States government, whether you're a man or whether you're a woman, if you point out, if you begin to sound the alarm about corruption, at that point, the government considers you an enemy of the state. And once you are targeted or once you are considered an enemy of the state, you know, the gloves come off and you are treated as a combatant, which means that they go after you with everything that they have in their arsenal. And, you know, we're talking about the most powerful, the wealthiest, the most violent, you know, nation on earth. And so when all of that force is arrayed against an individual, it becomes overwhelming. So that's one part of it, is the enemy of the state part on the United States side. Overseas, you know, it's a question of money, quite frankly. Their resources, the United States government, security issues or needs that the government has. And if countries happen to possess those strategic minerals, like in South Africa or Iraq, then the country, the United States government, starts to provide the kinds of force it needs to extract those resources. In my situation, I was at the United States Environmental Protection Agency. I found out about a U.S. multinational corporation that was exploiting, and in fact, the reports that I received was that people were dying and becoming injured. And when I reported it and I refused to stop talking about it, then all that force was basically targeted towards me. And that's sort of where my story starts.
And that was the case of vanadium, a metal that's used to stop metal from cracking when it reheats too many times. And that was easily solved, perhaps, with some basic health protection for foreign workers. And it's not an isolated case. We have the Bhopal disaster in India, and just lately, these Chinese workers dying from dangerous conditions making parts for Apple. What should legislators be doing to ensure we aren't killing people who make the products we all buy?
Right. Well, yeah, vanadium is used as an alloy in steel, and so it helps the steel contract and expand. And so it's important for your listeners to know what vanadium is used in, because we are all the beneficiaries of the hard work of vanadium workers. Vanadium is used in forks and spoons and cars and trucks and refrigerators and planes. Anytime steel is exposed to hot and cold conditions, most likely it has vanadium in it. So vanadium is a part of our everyday lives that we don't even notice that we use steel, because steel is such an important, it undergirds our society. It is the sacrifice of the South African vanadium workers which allows us to live, to kind of have the kind of lifestyle we have in this country. And more importantly, I should say, in terms of my theme again of green crimes, is that the vanadium or steel is a very important part of green technology in terms of windmills or, you know, invective roofs or solar panels. Vanadium, steel is a part of all those new green technologies. So even our green technologies are based upon the exploitation of South African vanadium mine workers. And so what I tried to do was something very basic, and that was I successfully was able to usher through a resolution through the committee that I work for, which is the Gore Mbeki Committee. And that is that two vice presidents came together, the vice president from South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, who eventually became the president of South Africa, and Al Gore. And so I was the head of the Environment Committee under the Gore Mbeki Committee. And so what I did was I ushered in a resolution that would allow, that in which the United States government and South Africa agreed to allow an independent team of scientists to go to South Africa and to investigate whether or not these workers were actually dying from vanadium poisoning. Obviously, that's the first step in making a decision as to how we proceed. And that report was stymied. It was crushed.
Well, our guest is MIT-trained Dr. Coleman Adebayo, the whistleblower who sued the EPA and won. And Marcia, the racial bias of pollution isn't just overseas. I interviewed people from WE Act, a group in Harlem. They complained that whenever there was a need for a new waste dump or a polluting bus yard, it all went to Harlem. What would you say about the persistent pollution of African Americans and the price they pay in their health?
Well, it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I think that the ratio is that like 60% of all African American kids have neurotoxic levels of lead in their brains, which, as you know, causes all kinds of learning disabilities and motor problems. During the last, you know, Gulf oil spill, Lisa Jackson, the African American head of the EPA, signed off on BP dumping, sort of overlooking a white community that was the next on the list for receiving waste, and they basically skipped over that community and dumped the waste from BP in a black community. They allowed primarily black prisoners to clean up and to be exposed to petroleum waste from BP. But this is not an isolated incident. I mean, this is just the way the United States government has operated when it comes to what they consider disposable communities. And the African-American community, to a large extent, has been considered disposable. So it's something that we have to constantly fight against. And even the community in South Africa, which is also a community, you know, which I think those in power would consider disposable, because the people make very little money. There's a very large pool of unemployed people to take the place of those who are being injured and dying in South Africa. And so they just go in, they injure, they harm the workers, and then essentially they find new workers to take their place.
And there are some good people in government in the United States who try to right these wrongs, and they pay a big price. What happens to whistleblowers?
Well, to a large extent, you know, there are two things that happen. One is that we have the incredible opportunity of living out, you know, a very important basis of who we are as human beings, and that is telling the truth, doing the right thing, trying to save lives. That I'm not really sure how you put a monetary value on that. On the other hand, the state does what it does best, and that is that when it finds a foreign body inside of a system that they consider dangerous to the larger system, all the forces of that system moves fairly quickly to eliminate that foreign body. The foreign body that I'm talking about right now are whistleblowers. And so the federal government acts as any system does, you know, whether it's a physical system of your body and it's trying to counteract a cold or flu and all the various parts of the body sort of move to attack that virus and to eject it so that the body can be healthy. In the federal government, you have a very similar system where, you know, you have a system that sort of is where corruption is embedded as a part of the basic operating function of the system, because you're dealing with a system that protects corporations and protects what we call in the Occupy movement the 1%, so that when you have what that system considers almost like a foreign body embedded in the system, almost all the different parts of the system move to eject that foreign body. And those are whistleblowers or truth tellers. And so what's interesting about your question is that most people, when they blow the whistle, don't even know that they're blowing the whistle. Whistleblowers are made. They're not born. So that when you're in a system and you're trying to do the right thing, you're just trying to do your job, and you literally trip upon an issue like I did with the vanadium workers, and you just casually tell a supervisor, you know what, there's something that's not right about these figures, or there's something that's just not right about whatever it is. And then all of a sudden the system understands exactly what you said, even though perhaps you don't understand what you've discovered. And before you know it, the playbook, what I talk about in my book, No Fear, the playbook goes into action. So all of a sudden, an employee who's done quite well and is maybe even a very valued employee starts receiving negative comments in their personnel file. Their performance ratings start to dive north, and you're trying to figure out, what did I do wrong? But, you know, most people realize, okay, well, you know, I told the supervisor this, and I've been told to sort of clam up on it. And before you know, the system has moved fairly quickly to eliminate you. Because I'm still in litigation against the EPA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm still in litigation because the EPA, because I was fired. Even though I won my case and I passed a major law, I was fired. And so I'm actually going back into the courtroom now, again, the second time, against the Lisa Jackson administration to prove that the EPA fired me because I spoke out against vanadium poisoning.
It's still never over.
It's never over. It's never over.
Tell us about the battle to get the No Fear Act passed and what it does.
Yeah, the No Fear Act was the first civil rights and whistleblower law of the 21st century. It was an enormous battle to get the law passed. I was very fortunate and blessed to win my law case in 2000. It was amazing because once I won my case, the system just sort of erupted, because individuals are never supposed to be able to win against a government. And so only 2% of us win. And so it was considered quite newsworthy when I won. Congress invited me to testify. After I testified before Congress, a bill was introduced, interestingly enough, by a very conservative member of Congress, F. James Sensenbrenner from Wisconsin, and a very liberal member of Congress, Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas. And it took 2 years, and we organized a group called the No Fear Coalition, and it was composed of the bravest and most noble people, some of the most noble people inside of the federal government. We lost people. There were people who actually died from stress and literally the stress of fighting for the bill, because once the government found out that they were a member of the group, their jobs were placed at risk. And for some people, for all people, I think that's an enormous burden to carry, particularly if you're a single-family head of household. But people were fired. We lost 2 people in the struggle. We demonstrated. We faxed. We did all the things that you're supposed to do to pass the law. And we were extremely fortunate to have people step forward and to support us. And after 2 very, very, very long, difficult years, we passed the law. One interesting part about passing this law is that I was obviously invited to the White House, and it was one of the most conservative presidents of this country signed it. United States government signed it. George W. Bush signed the first civil rights law. Interestingly enough, he doesn't even mention it in his autobiography that he signed the first civil rights law. So he obviously wasn't very, I don't know, I don't want to prejudge what he was thinking, but I was standing behind the president when he signed the law. As he was signing the law, all I could remember were all the people who I had met along that journey who had not made it to see the signing of this civil rights law. And I started to cry, literally, as he was signing the bill. And he stood up and he sort of took me in his arms. And I was saying to him, you know, so many people didn't make it to see this day. And then just realized that he hadn't finished signing and said, you know, I can cry later. Why don't you finish signing the law? So what does the law do? The law protects whistleblowers inside the federal government by arming them with education and arming them with the knowledge so that they know how to protect themselves. So now in the United States, every federal government worker must take No Fear training every 2 years. If you join the federal government, you must be trained in your rights, in your civil rights, under law, within 90 days of joining the federal government. When I joined the federal government, I was trying to understand why no one seemed to care that they were about to lose a lot of money, because it was clear that I was going to win. It was what was happening to me was so outrageous. I mean, I was receiving death threats, rape threats. I was being called all kinds of racial epithets in the office. I was receiving threatening calls on my phone. I mean, I think everyone assumed, outside of an act of God, I was going to win this. And yet the federal government didn't seem, the EPA, I should say, didn't seem to care. And one of the reasons why we found out that EPA didn't care was because they were not going to pay the bill. The guys in the White House or whatever had set up a little slush fund in case people like the 2% of us who won. So the bill was literally sent to a slush fund at the Department of Treasury. So EPA had no stakes in whether I won or not, financial stakes. So what the no-fear law says now is that if an agency loses a discrimination whistleblower case, that agency pays for it out of their budget. And then the agency has to go to Congress and explain to the American people why their budget has been cut by $1 million or whatever the amount of money that they've lost because they've decided to protect discriminating managers. On every single federal government website, whether it's the White House or the FBI or the CIA, there is a No Fear icon that's posted on that front page. And when you click on the icon, all the data comes up for that agency in terms of how many people have filed discrimination complaints and what that status is. I mean, the law is quite extensive. And then on top of that, every 6 months, the president receives a no-fear file in which gives him a status picture of what's happening inside the federal government, as well as every single congressional office. So that's a nutshell of what no-fear does. And we're also, we've introduced no-fear 2, that provides congressional protection for people who contact their congressional member after blowing the whistle in the federal government. So that's a nutshell of what the law does.
And that is a huge accomplishment. We are running out of time. Is there a message you'd like to leave with our listeners?
The book has been optioned, I should say, for a movie by actor Danny Glover. And we're looking for people to work with us on the movie. Actually, this is a movie that's a bit different because we consider this movie a part of the activism. And so we're actually trying to get, we're actually enlisting the help of the public to make the movie. My website is www.marsha, M-A-R-S-H-A, Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N, hyphen, Adebayo, A-D-E, B as in boy, A-Y-O, .com. And you can buy my book on Amazon.com.
Right. So read her powerful story in the book, No Fear, A Whistleblower's Triumph Over Corruption and Retaliation at the EPA. And watch for that new film coming out, The Marsha Coleman Adebayo Story, from award-winning actor and producer Danny Glover. And our Washington area listeners can hear Marsha in person at the Writers' Center Sunday, February 19th at 2 p.m. Check out www.writer.org for details. Marsha, thank you so much for your time and for your dedication.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be with you.
Find out more about this program in our blog at ecoshock.info. Subscribe to our free podcast at the website, ecoshock.org. Next week, we'll talk about the emergency in the Arctic with some of the world's best climate scientists. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back.